In a world obsessed with achievement and status, Luke Russert made a decision that shocked many, walking away from a prestigious career as an NBC correspondent to embark on a global journey of self-discovery. The son of legendary journalist Tim Russert, Luke had spent years living in his father's shadow, building a successful career that mirrored his father's path while suppressing his own grief and identity questions. When his father died suddenly in 2008, Luke was thrust into the spotlight at just 22, expected to carry on the family legacy. 8 years later, he made the radical choice to step away from it all. Look For Me There has become a surprise bestseller, resonating with readers seeking meaning in their own lives and connecting with celebrities like Brené Brown and Oprah, who featured it in her book club selections for its raw honesty about grief and identity. The call came while I was outside a Florentine bar, my girlfriend Jeannie inside watching soccer with local fans during a warm Italian evening. It was my father's assistant, her voice trembling, asking if my mother was with me. Dad had fainted and was headed to the hospital. In that moment, standing on those ancient cobblestones, my world shifted. I knew with devastating certainty that Tim Russert doesn't faint. He was too strong, too vital, too present to simply faint. Just hours earlier, he had called me from my apartment where he was setting up my cable and Xbox, typical of his hands-on parenting style. He had been excited about getting everything ready for my return, planning our future father-son gaming sessions. Now we were making frantic calls across time zones to notify family before NBC broke the news. Tom Brokaw, fighting back tears, delivered the announcement that would shake the political journalism world. Mom and I walked Florence's medieval streets in shock, our footsteps echoing off buildings that had witnessed centuries of grief, making a solemn pact to grieve with dignity and honor Dad's remarkable legacy. At the funeral, surrounded by Washington's power brokers and journalism elite, I delivered a eulogy that resonated deeply with the gathered dignitaries and friends. The Kennedy Center was packed with faces I'd grown up watching on television, now all turned toward me with tear-filled eyes. When I spoke, a supernatural wave of calm washed over me, and I could almost hear Dad's encouraging voice. "You're doing great, buddy." His presence felt palpable. As we exited the Kennedy Center Memorial, where Bruce Springsteen had performed Thunder Road, Dad's favorite song, a magnificent rainbow appeared over the Potomac, nature's own sign that Dad was at peace. Several TV executives, impressed by my composure in such a public moment of grief, began approaching me about future opportunities in broadcasting. After Dad's death, I accepted NBC's offer to become their special youth correspondent at large, a position created with my father's legacy in mind. My office sat just down the hall from Dad's old one, allowing me to maintain our connection through shared space and memories. I covered the historic 2008 election, traveling to both conventions and producing stories about young voters' perspectives during this watershed moment. The job came with significant challenges, a vaguely defined role, complex office politics, and fierce external criticism about nepotism that cut deep. "Luke Russert sucks big time, and NBC should fire him now," one particularly brutal blog post screamed, reflecting the intense scrutiny I faced as Tim Russert's son. Election night proved a professional high point as I covered Obama's surprising Indiana win, eventually earning an Emmy as part of NBC's coverage team. Through persistence and determination to forge my own path, I convinced my bosses to let me work as a Capitol Hill reporter, where I discovered my true professional home among the marble corridors and political intrigue my father had so loved. Working at the Capitol felt like being part of history. I outworked everyone, chasing congressmen into elevators and filing briefing notes at all hours. Soon I was on first-name basis with the speaker, receiving calls from senators and appearing regularly on air. Beyond my congressional beat, I guest-hosted programs on MSNBC and appeared on Weekend Today. By 26, I was handed an hour of national cable news airtime and even appeared as a panelist on Meet the Press. The brass ring felt within reach until a surprising conversation with Speaker John Boehner, who summoned me to his ceremonial office. "What are you doing here?" he asked cryptically. When I mentioned turning 30 soon, he advised, Junior, it's time for you to go do something, build something. You don't want to be a lifer here. His words haunted me, awakening questions I'd been suppressing. Was I living up to my father's legacy or trying to prove something to him beyond the grave? Did I even like this job, or was I addicted to its fame? What was my plan for life after 30, 40, 50? Dad died at 58. How much time did I have? Despite knowing the president and dining with senators and CIA directors, I felt shattered and inadequate. My anxiety intensified, panic attacks in the Capitol, trembling in audio booths like the one where Dad died. The cynicism grew as Trump dominated political coverage, culminating when my substantive report got bumped for Trump's reaction to Harambe the gorilla. During work laws, I would cyberwalk streets of Tokyo and Buenos Aires, wondering if at 30 I could break free from being a DC creature and finally process my grief for Dad. In October 2016, I embarked on the craziest thing I'd ever done, leaving NBC, journalism, my career, and DC behind to find myself through travel. Following Route 1 along Maine's coast, I discovered the stunning Nubble Lighthouse and ventured into northern Maine's forests. Deep in the woods, I narrowly avoided a deadly collision with a timber truck, swerving just feet from an embankment. This harrowing experience became transformative. Alone with my pug and my father's truck, I felt truly free for the first time in my life. With a new compact carry-on, freshly grown beard, and nervous excitement coursing through my veins, I boarded my first solo international flight to Argentina. My mother enthusiastically supported my journey to Patagonia, a place that had left such a spellbinding impression on her during her reporting days that she had spoken of it countless times throughout my childhood. Her eyes would always light up at the mention of its rugged landscapes and untamed wilderness. At Perito Moreno Glacier, I stood transfixed by its 97 square mile vastness, the mesmerizing blue outlined white ice stretching endlessly before me. The thunderous sound of breaking ice echoed across the viewing platform every few hours, a reminder of nature's constant movement. Seeing tiny figures, actually experienced trekkers, dotting the glacier field reinforced its immense scale in a way no photograph could capture. The glacier's face rose 200 feet above the water, its jagged surface creating a natural amphitheater of ice. I wished Mom could have seen it with me, though the photos I sent earned a prominent place on her kitchen bulletin board, nestled between family photos and cherished newspaper clippings. When planning my trip months earlier, Mom surprised me by asking to join me in Buenos Aires for Thanksgiving, marking our first mother-son adventure. From my cab window, Buenos Aires revealed itself as a fading but beautiful city that had once rightfully earned its title as the Paris of Latin America. Its regal splendor and immigrant energy still hovered like persistent ghosts within the aging edifices of Recoleta and San Telmo, and among the proud Portenos who remained resilient despite decades of political upheavals and economic uncertainty. For Thanksgiving, we joined my friend Paige, an American expat who had fallen in love with and married a Porteno 5 years earlier. Mom, though slightly overdressed in her silk blouse and pearls compared to the casual crowd of diverse internationals, became the magnetic center of the gathering. She effortlessly connected with everyone, from Chilean artists to British bankers. As bottles of Mendoza Malbec flowed freely, Mom captivated the room with stories from her impressive journalism career. From writing 8 cover stories for Newsweek in the 1970s about cultural icons like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen, to her more recent Vanity Fair articles ranging from dangerous investigations into the Afghan opium trade to exclusive interviews about Katie Holmes escaping Scientology. Her storytelling had everyone leaning in, hanging on every word. Walking back to our hotel through the warm Buenos Aires night after this wonderful evening, I asked Mom where her seemingly boundless energy and ability to connect with strangers came from. "When I was a little girl in Minnesota, people always told me that I talked too much," she said with a knowing smile. "I guess I learned to use it to my advantage now. Besides, asking questions is the only way to really learn something about people in the world. Her words, simple yet profound, perfectly encapsulated both her success as a journalist and her approach to life. After my transformative time in New Zealand, I arrived in Cambodia with newfound patience and perspective. I'd come to see Angkor Wat, which I first glimpsed in a yellowed photograph of my mother doing a playful headstand at one of the temples in 1975. This massive temple complex, built in the 12th century as tribute to the Hindu god Vishnu, spans over 400 acres, with elaborate stone structures now dramatically intertwined with centuries-old strangler fig and banyan tree roots. The marriage of nature and architecture creates an otherworldly atmosphere that no photograph can truly capture. The five iconic carved towers pierce the horizon like ancient fingers reaching toward heaven, surrounded by swampy greenery and a vast moat that reflects the sky like polished glass. These towers represent the pinnacle of Khmer architecture and ancient grandeur, each intricately decorated with scenes from Hindu mythology. The crowds of disrespectful tourists pushing and shoving for Instagram photos disturbed me deeply, their selfie sticks and loud chatter seeming to desecrate this sacred space. Seeking solitude, I discovered a hidden Buddhist altar in a smaller, forgotten temple where I felt inexplicably compelled to meditate. For half an hour, I sat in a trance-like state, the sweet scent of incense and distant chanting blocking out worldly concerns as I found clarity amid chaos. I came to Vietnam carrying the weight of family history. Vietnam had shaped my parents' lives profoundly. My father's passionate anti-war activism that defined his college years, my mother's journalistic skepticism born from questioning wartime propaganda, yet neither had ever visited. As the first in my family to come here, I arrived not to the war-torn jungles of their generation's nightmares, but to a modern Hanoi airport with gleaming floors, efficient air conditioning, and friendly drivers offering bottled water and Wi-Fi passwords. At dawn, I visited Hoa Lo Prison, the infamous Hanoi Hilton, where John McCain spent 5 grueling years as a POW. Standing in his preserved cell, barely large enough to lie down, I contemplated McCain's extraordinary courage, refusing early release despite brutal torture when his Admiral father's identity was discovered, steadfastly honoring the military code that POWs must be released in order of capture. Most remarkably, McCain later forgave his captors, saying, "I hold no ill will toward them." The dank walls seem to whisper stories of both human cruelty and transcendent grace. In search of beauty after the prison's emotional heaviness, I journeyed to Ha Long Bay, whose name means descending dragon. Aboard a weathered wooden junk boat, I drifted through impossibly calm green waters, past thousands of limestone karsts and islets, their moss-covered faces rising like ancient tree stumps from the Emerald Sea. With no Wi-Fi to distract us, travelers from a dozen nations actually connected over cheap rice wine and local beer, sharing travel stories and solving world problems late into the night. The moonlight spread like a white silk bedsheet over the bay, and in that moment, surrounded by strangers turned friends, I felt the healing power of natural beauty and human connection. I recalled Henry Miller's words that one's destination is never a place, but rather a new way of looking at things, as I pointed my compass toward Africa. Landing in Senegal, I was confronted with the sign, "Welcome to Senegal, the gateway to West Africa." Fitting, since this coastline was where America's original sin began, the starting point for countless enslaved people. The ferry took us to Gori Island, where my guide Umar pointed out the door of no return. Though scholars debate the numbers, local history claims this was the last piece of African land millions saw before being shipped to slavery in the Americas. At this infamous doorway, I stared at the ocean, something I'd always associated with freedom, now symbolizing humanity's cruelest chapter. When Umar asked how I felt, I could only answer, ashamed. Later, I joined locals watching Senegal defeat South Africa 2-0, securing their first World Cup spot since 2002. The victory unleashed euphoria, men dancing in streets, car horns blaring, flags waving everywhere. At an upscale outdoor cafe, I shared my cigarillos with a dignified, well-dressed local man. The night led me to a vibrant lounge where hundreds were bound by love for Senegal. I was jolted awake at 5:30 a.m. in Zimbabwe by my friend Johnny from the American Embassy warning me that tanks are rolling through the streets of Harare. Though officials claimed it wasn't a coup, Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's longtime dictator, was being forced out. Though I was in Victoria Falls, far from the capital, I immediately booked a flight to Johannesburg. Raw fear crept in as I paced my hotel room, checking Twitter for updates, while the hotel clerk maintained everything was normal, despite the obvious tension. While hotel guests remained oddly calm, Twitter kept me informed about Mugabe being detained in the presidential palace. I called Owen, my driver, who confirmed the Zambian border was closed, but the airport remained open. As we sped toward the airport, Owen reassured me, "I don't think most people would fight for Mugabe." A mile from safety, we encountered a police checkpoint. Owen instructed me to move to the back seat and told the armed officers he was driving an important diplomat. They waved us through. Leaving Amman behind, I traveled through desolate roads toward the Israeli border crossing. My Jordanian driver played Adele as I worried about potential delays, shutdowns, or being denied entry due to my passport stamps from countries hostile to Israel. After passing through the Jordanian checkpoint, our bus moved through no man's land, marked by watchtowers and barbed wire, finally crossing the River Jordan into Israel. On the Israeli side, young armed soldiers directed our bus to processing. Despite the tense environment with rifles and stern officials, I felt strangely unafraid, resigned to fate, convinced I was meant to be here. In Jerusalem, I was surprised that the regional strife affected me less than expected. Instead, I was engulfed by religious solemnity that helped explain the intensity of local conflicts. Beliefs were fervent because faith permeated every ancient stone. At dawn, I visited the Mount of Temptation outside Jericho, where Jesus fasted for 40 days and resisted the devil's temptations. Seeing this stark desert mountain made Jesus' story more tangible. Something told me to notice things today, and I felt an inner calm spreading through my body as I found a quiet spot away from my tour group. At dusk, I followed an inner voice directing me to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Walking Jesus' path to crucifixion, I arrived just before closing time. At the altar of the crucifixion, I was physically pushed to my knees by the weight of the moment. Finally reaching Christ's tomb, I knelt before the stone slab and prayed, thanking God for my blessings, praying for those suffering, asking for continued safety, and pleading for guidance about my purpose since losing my father. As I prayed, I felt the stone trembling beneath my forehead. I entered a deep meditative state, feeling myself spinning into another dimension as an inner voice told me, "He heard you. Go forward. Pray, and you'll notice." In mid-September, I found myself in Los Angeles with my mother for the 70th Primetime Emmy Awards. Her book Vulgar Favors had been adapted into the hit series The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story, nominated for 18 awards. At the red carpet, Mom got the spotlight while I was relegated to handler status. When she wished I could have joined her in front of the cameras, I admitted, "I have no business being up there." The next day, instead of flying home with Mom from Tucson, I impulsively decided to drive to Marfa, Texas. On the road, I received an email from Mary ending our relationship due to my restlessness and lack of direction. I sped recklessly through the desert, stopping only for gas. In Marfa, I visited the iconic fake Prada store, posted the obligatory Instagram photo, and spent a night drinking with locals. The next day, I continued my aimless journey to Abilene, where I drank excessively and embarrassed myself at a country bar. After a late-night fast food binge, I woke up hungover and unrecognizable, finally confronting how far I'd strayed from my journey's original purpose of self-growth. Upon returning to DC, I visited my cardiologist, who delivered sobering news. My health had regressed significantly, undoing years of progress. I'd been using travel as a distraction, a drug, an escape from truly understanding myself. My social media performances replaced genuine introspection, as I feared confronting potential disappointment and the possibility of remaining forever unfulfilled. Walking home, I questioned my journey, breaking away from my job, relationship, hometown, wondering what I had to show for it. Though travel opened my eyes, I was now lost. I began running without music, letting my inner monologue flow, hearing Dad's encouraging words, "You got this," as I pushed through pain. I realized I needed to be on my own side. I cut back on drinking, improved my diet, and found a therapist. I learned to embrace my anxieties rather than compartmentalizing them. I'd been white-knuckling my life, never properly processing Dad's death or my fears of inadequacy and mortality. Through therapy, prayer, and medication, I began looking deeper into myself, reading old journals that revealed more honesty than I'd admitted to myself. After my profound experience at Christ's tomb, I walked through old Jerusalem's darkened streets to the Western Wall. I noticed a Buffalo Bills yarmulke for sale, a clear sign from Dad. This journey had forced me to confront the question, "Who am I beyond my father's son?" I reflected on Dad's words from his book, "To whom much is given, much is expected." I'd had this tattooed on my arm, but it had haunted me with feelings of inadequacy. I realized I'd been trying to bear the cross of a legend, attempting to reconstruct meaning after loss by continuing Dad's legacy. But in this moment of clarity, I understood I must forge my own path, finding comfort within uncertainty rather than clinging to duty. I'm not just my father's son or my mother's son, but my own person with my own voice. I'd been holding on to 22-year-old Luke, the age I was when Dad died, fearing that letting go meant losing him too. But there in Jerusalem, I'd glimpsed the man I'd become, one who meditates, embraces global influences, invests in causes beyond media, and perhaps someday has a family of his own. I understood Dad would always be with me, his love within me. At the Western Wall, wearing the Bills yarmulke, I wrote Dad's favorite verse on a slip of paper. "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith." I folded it, kissed it, and slipped it into a crack in the ancient stones. In a letter to my father, I acknowledged how difficult it had been to read the letter to Luke he wrote at the end of his book. His words about never being entitled but always being loved resonated deeply with me. I was grateful for his reminder that the world doesn't owe me favors, but that I owe the world something, to live a good, decent, and meaningful life. I reflected on the one time I saw Dad truly cry, when he received a Father of the Year award and became overwhelmed with emotion looking at Grandpa and me in the audience. Though he wrote books about fathers and sons that helped countless people understand their own fathers better, I wondered what fears and anxieties he held inside, what he never shared. I explained that unlike him, I'd chosen to write candidly about my grief not to elicit sympathy, but because opening up about my scars had helped me heal. We're different in that way, but I hoped my words might help others as his did. I closed by assuring him I still believed in America's promise, even in tough times. I told him I missed him, loved him, and promised to be there when the Bills finally win a Super Bowl.